WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. North Korea has warned that the dispute over its nuclear program is pushing it to the brink of war. Last year, North Korea withdrew from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It refused to allow the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, to inspect its nuclear power plants. This secrecy has led to suspicions that the North Koreans are using the plutonium from their nuclear power program to develop bombs. Last week, the United Nations Security Council warned the North Koreans that if they don't allow a full inspection of their nuclear facilities, they may soon face a trade embargo. On Tuesday, North Korea angrily rejected the Security Council's demands. What does North Korea want? What's at stake for that country, its region, and the United States? We'll hear two different points of view today. My first guest is Selig Harrison, Senior Associate for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's been writing about North Korea since 1972, when he was the Washington Post's Tokyo bureau chief. He's visited North Korea three times and was most recently in South Korea last week. I asked him what North Korea is threatening to do.
North Korea is seeking to get diplomatic recognition and economic help from the United States, Japan, and South Korea, and it's using its nuclear weapons option as a bargaining lever to try to get those objectives achieved. They are not really threatening anything except that if they don't get a dialogue with the kind of concessions that they are seeking, they're going to go ahead and pursue the development of their nuclear program, which is essentially peaceful in its objectives, but which does involve the accumulation of plutonium that could be used for nuclear weapons, which of course is also true with respect to some other countries that reprocess plutonium, like Japan.
So North Korea wants to trade with the United States. They want economic recognition from the United States. But what would be in it for the United States to give that recognition to North Korea?
Well, North Korea is the last Stalinist regime in the world. And it's in the interest of the United States to draw it into contacts with the outside world that will lead to changes in that regime, gradual change of the kind that's been taking place in China. I think that the danger of a war in that part of the world would be progressively reduced as North Korea is drawn into trade and investment relationships with all of its neighbors and with the United States. And as certain policies that North Korea is now pursuing, such as the export of missiles to the Middle East, in order to earn foreign exchange, which it can't get through ordinary trade, that could be moderated if North Korea had a more balanced economic relationship with the rest of the world. And in general, the more it feels itself in a corner, surrounded, isolated by hostile countries, that aren't willing to cooperate with it economically, the more the danger that it will—you'll get leaders in North Korea who will do something irresponsible.
Well, what kind of dilemma does it create for the United States that North Korea is trying to pressure the United States into recognizing North Korea by the threat of nuclear war?
Well, I don't think they're threatening nuclear war. I think that's a misconception. North Korea has been trying to get the United States to pay some attention to it and to move toward the normalization of relations before the nuclear issue arose. And basically, we have a very negative image of North Korea resulting from the early Cold War years when their behavior and their terrorist activities have turned us off. So we've simply not responded. And they've turned to the nuclear issue as the best way to get our attention, after other ways failed. And I can speak to that because I've been going in there since 1972. I was one of the first American to meet Kim Il-sung after the Korean War, and even in 1972, they saw that the United States was going to get friendly with Russia and China, that détente was beginning, And they figured, they wondered what was going to happen to them in that situation. And even going back that far, they've been making overtures which we have consistently rejected. This whole dispute is misunderstood because they've repeatedly offered to give up their nuclear program and to agree to the inspection that the United States wants if we will conduct a negotiation on these other issues that they're interested in. We say that we won't. On November 11th, for example, last year, they made a proposal for what they call a package solution, a formal proposal to comply fully with the Non-Proliferation Treaty, to return to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and to reach other understandings with the U.S. regarding their nuclear program, if we would agree to their three major areas of interest: diplomatic recognition, economic help, and a pledge by the United States that we will not use nuclear weapons against them. Now, the American position is that they should do these things anyway, because they signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and therefore they're required to do them without any trade-off from our side. But there's a special angle to this story. When the North Koreans found early last year that we were not willing to negotiate with them, they said, all right, we'll leave the Non-Proliferation Treaty. That was, in a sense, moving the goalposts. It was playing the ultimate card. And the U.S. came back and said, no, please don't leave the Non-Proliferation Treaty. We will talk to you. But ever since then, we've been trying to get them to meet certain preconditions in the form of inspections before we would go ahead with the agreed discussions on diplomatic normalization and economic help. And the argument has been over who blinks first.
Do you think that North Korea is threatening nuclear war if the United States does not recognize it?
Oh, absolutely not. No, North Korea, if the United States does not negotiate with North Korea on diplomatic recognition and economic help, North Korea will simply proceed to develop its nuclear program for peaceful purposes, will acquire plutonium, which could give it the ability to make nuclear weapons, if it could master some of the technical obstacles it hasn't yet mastered. They have to learn how to make a trigger and other things. And so I think they're simply trying what the only weapon they have to get us to help them. And if we don't, I think they'll simply go back into their shell, and we will then be very worried. And the Japanese advocates of nuclear weapons in Japan will say, well, North Korea is trying to develop nuclear weapons. Maybe we should have nuclear weapons, too. In South Korea, the advocates of nuclear weapons will say the same thing. So the problem is not North Korea waging a nuclear war in the United States. The real reason why we should be concerned about North Korea's nuclear program is that it does encourage the nuclear hawks in Japan and South Korea. And a nuclear-armed Japan would really have a major impact on the world power situation. And I believe this whole nuclear issue is greatly exaggerated, the danger posed by North Korea's acquiring some plutonium. So do the Chinese. The Chinese are hesitant. They keep telling us to take it easy on this issue because they feel there's a big difference between accumulating a little bit of plutonium and being able to make nuclear weapons, which involves other technology that is needed.
Doesn't it look bad, though, for the United States to consider giving in to the kind of blackmail that North Korea is trying now?
That's the most difficult argument in this, that if we accede to North Korea's demands for concessions, we will be setting a dangerous precedent that might be used by Iran or other countries. The problem is that we have, at the present time, more than 9,000 nuclear weapons. And we are not ruling out the use of nuclear weapons in our military strategy. Indeed, Secretary Defense Perry just the other day made it clear that we're going to keep nuclear weapons as a part of our military strategy. As long as that's the case, we're fair game for blackmail. No self-respecting country in the world will accept a situation so unequal, where we assert the right to have nuclear weapons, to use them first in a conventional war, and tell them they can't even have a little plutonium to give them the option of making nuclear weapons. In the case of Korea, we have not ruled out the first use of nuclear weapons against North Korea in the event of what we consider a nuclear, a conventional attack against South Korea.
I believe that North Korea has said that if the United States organizes sanctions against North Korea, North Korea will interpret that as an act of war. They will respond by calling for war?
Well, I
clarify
think,
that for me.
Yes, North Korea. The North Korea has said that it would treat the invocation of economic sanctions by the UN as an act of war, which would give it the right, as far as it's concerned, to retaliate militarily against South Korea, against the American forces in South Korea. I think that the most dangerous thing is that once you get economic sanctions, then there are going to be demands for a naval blockade to enforce the sanctions, because ships could come in with oil, it's going to be very difficult to enforce the sanctions without a naval blockade. That is when I think North Korea might very well resort to some military retaliation against South Korea. But the North Koreans are not looking for a war. They don't have much petroleum these days because Russia and China aren't providing it. They have to pay cash on the barrelhead for it, and they don't have much foreign exchange available. The last thing they want is a war. But they certainly would feel that their national honor requires some kind of a response if they're subjected to a naval blockade. So that's the real danger. Sanctions as such might not trigger a military catastrophe in Korea. But once you go across once you get into military enforcement of the sanctions, then I think we're really asking for another Korean War.
What do you think the odds are that there will be another Korean War?
Well, I think that there is still hope that because of the feelings in China and in Japan and in South Korea, the desire to avoid another Korean War, the United States will gradually find a way to get back into dialogue with North Korea. I hope so. It's a 50-50 situation, but just yesterday, Prime Minister Hosokawa of Japan made a statement in conjunction with the South Korean foreign minister that appears to have urged the U.S. to get back into dialogue with North Korea. So I think Japan, South Korea, and China are going to force the United States to pursue a diplomatic option, but it's going to be a very dicey situation, and unless this is resolved by June, North Korea may take steps relating to its nuclear program, which would make it much harder to ever find out how much they have accumulated.
You just got back from South Korea. What were you looking for there?
Well, I was trying to find out how South Korea really felt about this issue. And I think that it's a country that's deeply divided between its own hawks and doves. And the government is not entirely free to do what it thinks best because it's under pressure from the right wing in South Korea to be tough toward North Korea and not let the U.S. go too far. The South Koreans go too far in making a deal with North Korea. South Koreans are, on the one hand, they certainly don't want a war, and therefore they're very nervous when we appear to be pursuing provocative, what they consider provocative, tactics toward North Korea. On the other hand, they don't want the United States to get too friendly with North Korea and give it too much help because of the traditional feelings of animosity between North Korea and South Korea left over from the Korean War after all these years.
My guest is Selig Harrison. He's a senior associate with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And he's been focusing on North and South Korea since 1972 when he was Tokyo bureau chief for the Washington Post. We're going to take a short break, then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about North Korea with Selig Harrison, senior associate for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. You intend to go to North Korea sometime in May. Is it hard to get in?
Well, it's not a country you can just apply to, you just automatically get a visa for. In my case, I went there first in 1972. I've been back three times. They know that I try to write objectively about the situation. They don't like a lot of things I write. So we have their periods when they are very unhappy with what I'm writing and criticize me. But at the same time, they have to have some... They want people to come into North Korea who will write about it in what they think is an objective way, and they do let Americans in and journalists in from time to time.
How difficult is life in North Korea under Kim Il-sung?
Well, it's a very tight ship. There is no freedom. Some people have compared it to the medieval church. Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times wrote an article in which he said North Korea is like the medieval church, where most people are true believers. Just as in the Middle Ages, people tolerated the persecution of heretics, so in North Korea, people tolerate what are obviously continuing human rights violations by Western standards. But the average person in North Korea has an assurance of housing and of medical care, and the country has made significant economic progress. Problems, first of all, have to do with adequate food supplies at the present time. There's not very much meat in North Korea. The quality of their grain available to them is not very good at the present time. They don't have much petroleum coming in, so their buses and subways are not necessarily operating at full capacity. Some of the factories are even idle at the present time because of the cutoff of oil subsidies from China and Russia that they enjoyed during the Cold War, and the fact that they don't have foreign exchange because of their lack of foreign trade to buy oil on the open market. So it's a hardship situation at the present time. Some of the picture of this hardship has been exaggerated. There's no famine. People aren't starving. People aren't revolting. But because they have to spend so much money on their military to defend themselves against what they see as the danger of a South Korean-American move to overthrow them and create what happened in Germany and Korea, they spend five times more of their GNP on defense than South Korea does. The result is they starve their consumer goods industries. And that means that the average person in North Korea doesn't have the quality of consumer goods available to people all over the countries of Asia surrounding North Korea.
And what will you be looking for when you go to North Korea in May?
Well, I'll be looking. It's very hard for an outsider to find out much about the nuclear program. If the IAEA can't get access to some of these things, no outside scholar or journalist can. But what you can find out is what is happening in the leadership there, what kind of people, whether their leadership is really moving in a direction which is interested in contact and change, contact with the outside world, opening up to the outside world. All the indications from the outside are that process is moving fast, that the more moderate elements in North Korea are becoming more influential. When you go there and you talk to a variety of the leaders, you can get a sense of the internal situation there. And that helps you in evaluating what's going on, and in deciding what you think our policy should be. One of the reasons I'm so clear in my own mind about what I think the United States should be doing, namely making a deal with North Korea, cooperating with them to help to open them up and normalize relations, is that I've been watching it in recent years, and I do see a big change internally in their attitude toward the outside world and a real desire to join the outside world and to end this isolation that they've had for so many years during the Cold War.
In the meantime, the United States has sent Patriot missiles to South Korea.
Well, that was an understandable move on our part because it is a dicey situation, and the Patriot missiles, a defensive weapon. And the North Koreans, although they've blustered about it a bit, are well aware that it's a defensive weapon, and they aren't really as upset about that as they might be about some of the other weapons we're talking about sending in, which have an offensive capability. So I think the Patriots were understandable from the point of view of the Clinton administration, because to show Americans that we're not unconcerned about what might happen if there is another war there, what might happen to our forces there, and to show South Korea that we're committed to their defense if there is another war. But I think that if we get into an economic sanctions vote and then a naval blockade, that's when we begin to provoke North Korea, threaten North Korea militarily. If we send weapons to South Korea that are essentially offensive in character, if we go back to a resumption of these military exercises called Team Spirit, which we have been conducting every year with South Korea, which until very recently were kind of nuclear war games. You see, the United States had tactical nuclear weapons in South Korea until 1991. And it was the fact that they were there that led to the North Korean nuclear program in the first place. Now, the Team Spirit military exercises involve games that envisage the use of potential nuclear weapons in a crisis. That's the reason the North Koreans are so upset about them and don't want them. So I think that would be provocative. But the Patriot missiles themselves were an understandable American response.
One last question. Do you think that what we're seeing in North Korea is going to be happening more and more, that a small country under a dictatorship will be using plutonium or their nuclear industry as a bargaining chip?
I don't think there are too many cases like this. North Korea has been peculiarly isolated. We've been peculiarly unwilling to deal with them. Most of the other countries that are potential nuclear powers, we have much more normal, friendly relations with. And I really don't see the danger of a massive duplication of this problem. We've been willing in the Ukraine and in Kazakhstan to make it economically worthwhile for those countries to cooperate in destroying their nuclear weapons and in signing the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. There's no reason why we shouldn't do that in North Korea also. But I think that the only way to really make sure that we aren't subjected to pressures of this kind is to decide that nuclear weapons are not going to be a part of our military strategy in the future, and to move slowly and carefully, with an eye on what everybody else is doing, to gradually reduce and eliminate nuclear weapons in the world. As long as we are committed to the idea that we have a right to use them in our own military strategy, we certainly can't expect other countries not to want to have nuclear weapons of their own.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Hope it's been helpful.
Selig Harrison is Senior Associate for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.